Blog
Sun's on my back, wind's in my ear. I haven't felt this good in years. See all the people in the field all lined up in a row. We got a couple more long hours of work before it's time to go. We're all
good morning and welcome to Those Darn Guys Who Happen to Be Therapists. I'm Dr. Jim Weaver. And today, my co-host is going to be Dr. Mark Kiefner, the clinical director of Bayside Neuro Rehabilitation Center, because Hughes Kraft is on vacation, so I'm very excited about having Mark as my co-host. Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Jim. Good morning. How are you?
Good, good.
Have a good weekend.
I had a good weekend, yes. And you, sir?
Excellent.
All right. So, let me just give people the call-in number, 347-677-1667, and just remind people that next week, in which Dr. Mark Kiefner is going to be with me again, we're going to have Dr. Joe Melnick talking about the S Factor, a DVD program for couples that's being promoted very strongly on television these days. So looking forward to that next week. So today, Mark, we're going to talk about trauma and transformation. And let's start out with what is trauma? This is psychotherapy with people who are having an injury or some traumatic event. So let's talk about what is trauma.
Well, you know, trauma, at least in our practice, we deal with people that have physical trauma, obviously, in a rehab practice, but we also deal with people that have, individuals that have psychological trauma. And interestingly, probably because I'm a psychologist, interestingly, I think that the psychological trauma is often as difficult or sometimes even more difficult for people to manage and recover from. You know, if you injure yourself in a car accident or motorcycle accident or a work-related accident, you know, the physical healing can be done and over with relatively quickly. And if you're left with some sort of disability or some sort of limitation on what you can do, most people can make a phenomenal adaptation to that with all kinds of compensatory strategies. But the psychological part is more traumatizing and more limiting for people sometimes. Right. Want me to say a little more about that?
Well, let me just say, from my definition of trauma is something unusual, really out of the ordinary, and overwhelming. Somehow it's something very different that comes into your life. And sometimes it can be through physical injury. Sometimes it can be some psychological event. You know, some tragedy. People getting hurt or killed around you, devastation, those kinds of things. And it's hard for you to process that because it's so much out of your normal experience. And the question is, how do you get a handle on that? One of the things I've read in research is that, we have these teams which are called critical incident debriefing teams. And there was the sort of accepted knowledge or accepted practice that you went in and got people to talk about what happened. Sometimes that's re-traumatizing. So you really have to know who you're dealing with. Some people actually have a good system of denial and avoidance in the crisis of the trauma, and it's sometimes appropriate to support that. Other times it's really helpful for people to talk about it, especially people who are feeling guilt or shame about what happened or how they performed there.
I think the critical incident stress debriefing, we use that here with our employees, and I think that it's very commonly used, you know, for police departments and EMTs, right. firemen. And it's very much a cognitive process. It's not a very emotional or emotion-laden process. It's very much a factual processing. If you and I think one of the if you look at the EMDR literature, the eye movement desensitization literature, they talk about the fact that all of us process and recover from trauma relatively well, and that it's only the really big traumas that where we get stuck or frozen. And I think that going through that kind of cognitive process in critical incident stress debriefing allows people to process that information or process that event through to completion. And interestingly, when I worked in the VA hospital quite a while ago, during and post-Vietnam, one of the differences between Vietnam veterans and World War II veterans was that Vietnam veterans really didn't have the opportunity to process their experiences with fellow veterans on the way home. So they, in World War II, people usually came home on a ship, and so they'd be around other veterans talking about their experiences. And while there certainly was post-traumatic stress disorder in World War II, there seemed to be a much greater incidence of that in Vietnam, where people basically got on a plane, separated from their unit, and flown home right away. And so one of the ideas that came out of that is that people really need an opportunity to process the event with colleagues or coworkers or other people that have participated in the event. But I don't think that has to be an emotional processing as much as a cognitive processing and almost a kind of psychoeducational processing. And I think that allows that to sort of move through to completion more effectively.
The other thing that happened with Vietnam veterans, and I worked with a number of them too over the years, was that the people were very angry about the Vietnam War, and they misplaced that anger on the soldiers coming back from Vietnam. So they really felt like they weren't allowed to, or people weren't open to hearing about their experiences. And so not only did they not talk about it with their fellow soldiers, but they didn't talk about it with family, friends, whatever. It was like, just put that away. And when you sort of hide stuff from the light of day, it really festers and becomes much more virulent. Yeah. And I think, you know, back to the present and people who have injuries, I think sometimes you may find this, especially with men, I do, that they don't feel like they're supposed to talk about their feelings, or supposed to talk about being upset, or supposed to talk about feeling like breaking down, and so it's harder for them to get that out in the open and share what's happened to them. And there's this expectation in this country with all of the advertising and so forth that, you know, you're supposed to be healthy and hearty and active, and if you've got a disability, it can be hard to talk about it. You can feel a lot of shame about that.
Oh my God, I don't think it's just men. I think it's men and women. But I think unfortunately, we men are a little more afflicted with that.
Right.
Which is really sort of sad. But I think that when, you know, most of us are sort of going through life with the expectation that nothing bad is going to happen. I mean, most of us don't wake up every morning going, well, man, I could have a car accident on the way to work. I mean, we just go out there and we get involved in our routines, and we drive to work, and we expect to arrive there, and we expect to arrive there in one piece, and we don't expect anything bad to happen along the way. I mean, when we go to work, we don't expect a patient to pull a gun or a knife on us in the office, although that does occasionally happen. And
how many times has that happened to you?
Twice.
Twice. Wow, really?
Yeah.
Wow. Amazing. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, and I actually can't forget those events.
Right. But you're doing okay, right?
I'm doing all right. Thanks for asking.
You're welcome.
I like talking about that.
Okay. All right.
No.
you have a great phrase about that, shattered normalcy, and I think that's that describes it fairly eloquently. Your normal life is going along, and all of a sudden, boom!
Your normal life is not normal anymore.
Yep.
Yeah, it's not normal. Everything that was on your sort of pre-programmed list becomes optional now. And people go through an incredible process, and it's very similar to that Kubler-Ross grieving kind of process where they become angry and they become, they want to make a deal. You know, if only I could get my legs back, I would do this, or if only I could return to work, I would do that. And of course, you know, if you're a wage earner and you lose income and, a lot of people are living sort of paycheck to paycheck, and that puts an incredible stress on your family. And that's just and then you lose your role. And even if you've only lost your role temporarily, most of us are very attached to the roles we have, whether it's mother, father, wage earner, psychologist, neuropsychologist, electrician, plumber. And we derive a huge amount of our self-esteem and a huge benefit from that role. When we don't have that, it's sort of like, you remember I sometimes talk to people about, remember how painful those years in high school were where you just didn't really know who you were and kind of what you were going to be doing, and you're searching. And while there's some great times there, there's also that angst about who am I going to be. And
you had to bring that up.
You were not over that either. I'm hoping I can work through all my issues in this one show.
There you go.
But I talk to people that developmentally it's like being knocked back to high school.
Or earlier,
where you're still trying to figure out, what's my role going to be? What's my role going to be in this world and in this society? And that's a huge loss if you don't know what that is.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Some people do better with recovering this. I mean, one word for it is resiliency.
Yeah.
There's lots of, applications for resiliency from, childhood trauma to later trauma when you have a physical injury. You've done some thinking about who does better in terms of recovering.
I love that word resiliency. And as you know, there's a huge literature on positive psychology and resiliency at the moment. But the people who I think do the best are the people who have good family supports and good social supports and good affective connections with other people. And when you have those, you have a network to fall back on, and your identity isn't just your role that you're doing at that time in terms of your work or whatever it is that your hobby is, but it's you're part of a larger network. And the people who have had secure attachments, the people who have had people love them, I mean, as corny as that sounds, those people do better. And they recover better, and they are the people that that, of course, sort of look at life as the glass is half full.
Right.
And I was at a workshop over the weekend, and somebody said, is the glass half full or half empty? And one person, who I think is probably the most logical person in the room, said, actually, that's exactly the same.
To right.
re-explain that concept.
Yeah. Right. But the trick is, of course, which part are you going to focus on?
Yeah, and, what are you going to focus
on? Right. Exactly. Yeah, because, you know, focusing your attention is a very powerful thing. If you're focusing on the negative or all of the, you know, the problems and so forth, you're going to have a lot different approach than if you're focusing on the positive, you're focusing on the possibility.
Yeah.
Take anything away from the pain of dealing with a trauma or an injury. But sometimes it really results in people looking at what's important in life and what's, you know, what the meaning of life is for them. Sometimes when life is going smoothly, you don't really think about that. You don't examine it, and you can get into some really bad patterns of materialism and other things. And having to face something being taken away from you that's very precious, your mobility or your health, or in a traumatic event of seeing somebody else's life taken away from them, or their health taken away from them, it really gives you a perspective about what is the essence of life, and how to, you know, how to orient yourself into that approach or that attitude towards life.
You find that in working with the clients in your practice that a crisis or can actually provide them with an opportunity to kind of reexamine their life and find a more meaningful way to live their life after that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, that's, you know, that's part of what the whole process of working through it is. And, you know, it depends. I mean, some people are much better at examining themselves and examining their life. Some people are much better at, you know, one of the things that's helpful is flexibility, you know, is to actually change. I think one of the things we need to emphasize is that there's a grieving process that really has to be gone through. It's not like you say, okay, I'm going to look at the glass half full now that I've, you know, lost my ability to walk or whatever.
Right.
There's a process in which you say, I'm very, very angry, sad, upset. And you know, to be able to express all that and to be able to go through that in a productive way helps you then to go to the next phase, which is to start to reevaluate and reassess who you are now,
right.
What you want to do with your life now, what is the purpose and goal and meaning of your life now. So it's a tough, tough journey.
It can be a very difficult journey, and it can take, at least in my experience, it can take a fairly long time, depending
right.
on the kind of person you are, and also the kind of resiliency that you have and the severity of the trauma. But the thing that I always remind myself about is that we have natural mechanisms for healing trauma, just like we have natural mechanisms for healing injuries, physical injuries. And I often think about the fact that, you know, anybody that's been in a relationship for more than a week has probably had a moment where they kind of felt a little punctured or a little wounded, or you know, a sharp word was uttered, and they have some kind of little tiff, and yet a week later, you might remember that you had a little tiff, or you may remember that you had a fight, but you frequently don't remember what it was really about, and you don't remember the details of it. And that, I think that's an example of a little trauma that gets worked through and assimilated and kind of woven into the fabric of your life. And I think most of us, you know, we don't have to go see a psychotherapist about that, but...
Speak for yourself.
Maybe I should have seen a psychotherapist about that. Don't get off this number, Jim. I'm going to call you right after.
Really?
help me. But I think you know, the psychotherapy process works people through that in a very much the same way, but in a sort of a more guided kind of way.
Right.
You know, the other we haven't talked about. Can I talk about EMDR here for a minute?
You can. I'm going to let you talk about EMDR.
Well, you know, I'm not an expert in EMDR, but I use it here in our practice, and I've had a difficult time using it for people with chronic post-traumatic stress disorder. But I know there are people who do use it for that. But I've had very good luck using it for people who have kind of a single episode or two episodes that they're kind of stuck on, and that they just have not been able to process through. And I think that it goes back to some of what you said in the beginning, which is that too much working through things emotionally can sometimes actually re-traumatize people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think EMDR can be a very effective way of moving people quickly to resolution of things.
Yeah. Why don't you say a little bit about what EMDR actually is, and what the theory behind it in terms of how it's geared to help.
Boy, that's a whole other discussion, but I'll do the cliff notes.
Well, I'm just thinking that you know there may be a number of people listening to us that sounds very mysterious.
EMDR stands for eye movement desensitization reprocessing, and started by a woman named Francine Shapiro, and she sort of discovered it reportedly by taking a walk in the woods and along a pathway and noticing that her eye movements that were occurring seemed to change the emotional experience she was having. So she developed a series of protocols for using this technique, and some very, in the beginning I was a little skeptical because it does sound a little strange, but there's a number of theories about how it works, but one of the theories is that there's kind of dual processing, so that you're, in a sense, occupying, I'm probably going to get into trouble with somebody who's really an expert in this, but you're occupying the one part of the mind or the brain and letting another part process the information in a different way. So instead of blocking the processing, you're actually opening a channel for the processing to occur. And it is in some ways, I think, similar to some of the things that are done in hypnosis, where you occupy the conscious mind with the idea that the unconscious mind or the subconscious mind will work through material while you're sort of distracting the conscious mind, and then people in the process of the treatment actually sort of use both. I shouldn't say both. It's actually three levels. I think cognitions, emotions or feelings, and physical sensations. So you're really attending to three levels of processing an event. So there's a physical or somatic level, there's the emotional or feeling level, and then there's the cognitive and thinking level. And so in the process of working through this, you're sort of paying attention to all three things. And I think that in itself is very powerful, because I think a lot of psychotherapy doesn't pay attention to all three things. It often pays attention to one of the three things, emotions or cognitions, or somatic experiences, but not often all three things together. So I think it allows for a kind of faster processing of things. That could be like a whole long discussion.
Okay.
There's the Flip Notes version.
Right. Okay, so we'll schedule that.
Yeah. With somebody who's really an expert, not me.
Well, I think that was a very good synopsis of it. You're the clinical director at Bayside Neuro Rehabilitation Services.
Talk about that.
And a little bit about what you do there, and how people get to you, I guess. And you've got 2 minutes.
I was born in Baltimore. I'll skip the first 50 years.
Good.
Bayside is, as you know, a day treatment program for people with neurologic injuries. So we see people who have had brain injuries, aneurysms, strokes, toxic exposure, encephalopathy, anoxia, hypoxia. Trying to think about anything else, but generally concussions. So we see people who have had all sorts of brain-related trauma or injury, and we see people from ages 7 or 8 to the fairly older than you and I in their 7. And what we offer is we usually start with a visit with me to kind of help determine what a person's needs are, and we do an initial interview. And then after that, we schedule people for services with some of our therapists. And we have occupational therapists and speech therapists and physical therapy and nursing and neuropsychology and counseling and substance abuse and recreational therapy, and we do a lot of things in the community with people in terms of moving them back toward school or moving them back toward employment. And we do a lot of work in groups, actually, which is really a very powerful experience, because people get a chance to, almost everyone who has an injury sort of feels alone, like, in the world. You know, like nobody's ever had an injury like mine, or nobody knows what I'm going through. And so it's often very powerful for people to be in a group and discover that they're not alone. And in fact, there is among our clients very much a sense of community that develops. And frequently in the beginning, people will come in and wonder, do I really belong here? Because they'll see someone who perhaps looks more injured than they are. Maybe they have trouble walking, or maybe they have some trouble with their speech. And you know, we've had clients who in this.
I'm going to give. Somehow Mark got cut off, and I'm not sure exactly why. It looks like. So anyway, we're going to have to head out now, and we'll be here next week with Dr. Joe Melnick and the US Factor, and we will talk to you then. So here's Meg and Joe Wilson. Take us away with Take Me Away.
My bones are aching, your back is tired, hold me close. times you're already up on stage. When I walk into the noise of the bar, I can't see the smoke or all the people laughing. I just see you shine.